Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Lots to share. From apples that can help you if you're exercising to flaxseed that could prevent broken bones. And a big meta-analysis, meta meaning many studies, that shows you why you should be consuming green tea. And a Harvard and UC California shows how your DHA in your diet turns off inflammation. Black beans, should be having more of them. And researchers have found a link between sound and fear. You think? Well, how many times have we had the sound in a film bring us to a level of tension? There are also some really good herbs that can help destroy mycoplasma. That's a really serious and can be life-threatening infection in the lungs. A lot of people have that, and I'll share that with you. We have so much original material, always from qualified, independent sources published in peer-reviewed literature done at major institutions. Now, I say that, and as anyone who's heard me over decades know, the alternative health movement has been under constant attack. Virtually every month, there's another article appearing by an uncritical mass media that challenges nutrients, herbs, diet. And now they have Paul Offit out there who's taken on the role of Stephen Barrett and in attacking everything in the alternative movement. Well, we are pushing back and we'll show where Offit, though he has absolutely a right to his opinion, he is wrong on all of his challenges. I gave a rebuttal about 3 weeks ago. We will continue to do so, but we do not have the access to the major media. If we have major discoveries, ours are virtually avoided. They have never reversed Alzheimer's. I have. They have never cured people with AIDS. I've cured 12, and they were all on, over a period of 8 years, Tony Brown's journal, all meticulously medically vetted. We have thousands of people whose lives have been changed. Not a word in the press. And if so, always with a derisiveness. And yet when they make claims of a new vaccine, well, for AIDS, well, hello, isn't it true you just infected everyone with AIDS in that experimental vaccine? Yeah. And haven't you done over 70 other experiments? Yeah. And failed at every single one? Absolutely. Ever reverse anything? No. But you don't have to reverse anything, improve anything, or help anyone. As long as you're in power, you control the dialogue. And the lapdog media, like the New York Times specifically, shame on them, not just for causing a war that's caused a million people to die, millions to be dislocated from their homes, a country to be permanently used with depleted uranium from the munitions, with thousands upon hundreds of thousands of children either miscarrying or being born with birth defects. You've never seen a real apology from anyone there, least of all Judith Miller, nor the editor-in-chief who was happy to let the world know that he made sure that the Obama administration, and before that the Bush administration, was happy with their reporting. I'm glad to know that the administrations and the CIA and Homeland Security and the FBI and private contractors are happy with your reporters. Good for you. And then there are real reporters, those who don't pretend to be fearful and self-censoring. My contempt for the people at the New York Times is palpable, but they should be held in contempt for the crimes against humanity they help perpetrate, but they won't be. They'll get more awards. That's how it works in this distorted society we live in. In any case, I intend to take on some of these people today. We're going to tell you the latest on WikiLeaks. They had a volunteer. Okay. Turns out it was a paid informant for the FBI working on the inside of WikiLeaks. My guest in the second part of our program will be Dr. Bruce Lipton. Dr. Lipton is, as many know, is an international authority on the new emerging biology into cellular activity and on the interface between science and spirituality. And we're going to talk about what epigenetics can inform us about in relationships and our sexuality. This will be a continuation of our series on conversations with remarkable minds. Anyhow, we go to great lengths to provide you with information you don't hear anywhere else from sources that are absolutely impeccable, and therefore they simply avoid it. Oh, and one other argument for those of you been telling us about the latest murder statistics around the world and how we must have this surveillance state. I hear this when I tune in to some of these media. It's a small price to pay giving up your first, your second, your Fourth Amendments for security. After all, we have a lot of murder. Look at Chicago. Okay, today I'll look at the latest statistics on murder per 100,000 citizens around the world. And then I'll ask you, based upon the actual statistics, should we even be entertaining an argument to surrender our security for less likelihood of having someone attack us? So as you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Apples are good for just more reason what you could imagine. But the latest comes from the peer-reviewed journal Cell Metabolism. And it was at the University of Iowa with an MD, PhD, Christopher Adams. Here's what he says. Quote, muscle atrophy causes big problems. It's also very common. It affects most people at some point in their lives, during illness or aging. But there's no medicine for it. We've studied muscle gene activity in people with atrophy and used that information to find chemicals that might block atrophy. One of those chemicals was especially interesting. It's called ursolic acid, and it's particularly concentrated in apple peels. Well, now here's what you should know, and this is one of the reasons why I'm always suggesting that everyone in this audience consume apples by eating them, but juicing them is also good. And it depends upon what you're trying to achieve. If you want to detoxify yourself and keep yourself cleansed and healthy, then green apples with lemon are your best combinations. If you want to help your immune system and keep your body strong, and especially your musculature system, then red apples. Now, the ursolic acid, ursolic, U-R-S-O-L-I-C, it works by boosting hormones that help build muscle. And these hormones also help reduce body fat, reduce your blood sugar, reduce your cholesterol. And in fact, every athlete should be consuming apple juice. In one particular laboratory study, it found that the ursolic apple concentrate, the acid, protected the creatures from muscle wasting. So that's why we should be having it. So if you're going to go out for a workout, make sure you have some apple juice. That'll help you. Now, there are a lot of questions being raised about, should we have flaxseed in the diet? The average American doesn't. Those in the health movement frequently do. And some people have the flaxseed that I do not recommend because it's generally go right through you without opening up. But a flax meal is extremely good, and the flaxseed oil is exceptionally good. This is from Ohio State College of Medicine. It says, a diet high in fish and flax helps prevent broken hips? Question mark. And this is especially true in postmenopausal women. So what they did is this. Scientists analyze red blood cell samples from women with and without a history of having a broken hip. And the study showed that higher levels of the omega-3 fatty acids from both plant and fish sources in those blood cells were associated with a lower likelihood of having fractured a hip. In addition to omega-3s, the researchers looked at omega-6 fatty acids, which are generally plentiful in the American diet. The study also showed that as the ratio of omega-6 fatty acids to omega-3s increase, so too did the hip fracture. So you don't want a lot of those omega-6s. You want your omega-3s. And that would be from flax oil and fish oil. Quote, inflammation is associated with an increased risk of bone loss and fractures, and omega-3 fatty acids are believed to reduce inflammation. So we asked if we could see fractures decrease in response to omega-3 intake. This is according to the study's senior author. One thing that was critically important was that we didn't use self-report of food intakes because there can be errors with that. We looked directly at the exposure of the bone cells to the fatty acids, which is at the red cell level. Red blood cell levels also give an indication of long-term exposure to these fatty acids, which we took into account in looking for a preventative effect. And broken hips are the most common osteoporosis-related fractures. 350,000 occur every year in the United States. 20% of people die in the following year. Why? Because of massive fracture. So, does it work? Yes. Should we be using it? Absolutely. Should you be a woman in menopause, postmenopausal? Every woman should be using the omega-3 fatty acids. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal of Bone and Mineral Research. Now, there was a big study. It's called a meta-analysis. And it was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And it was all about green tea. And could green tea protect your glucose level? That's your blood sugar level. The good news is, yes, it can. And then yes, 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 because in these studies it did. And this was in the Medical Nutrition Research Center, 17 separate trials, thousands of people. And what they found was those that consumed the most green tea on a daily basis were the ones who had the least osteoporosis and glucose imbalance. So glucose, blood sugar, for pre-diabetics and diabetics, people overweight, take your green tea and you can help yourself. A big study from Harvard, University of California, published in a very prestigious journal, the FASEB journal, look for the mechanisms of how the macrophages turn off inflammation when you take in a DHA. And a DHA, of course, is the omega-3 fatty acid I just mentioned in the previous study. And they found that chronic inflammation, which, by the way, is endemic in the United States, I'll bet 90% of the entire American population, I'm talking about almost 200 90 million Americans suffer from chronic inflammation. Everyone I've ever counseled suffers from some form of inflammation. And then you look at the American diet, you look at the people making healthy choices, and it pretty much correlates. Well, it's a major factor in almost every single disease. You can't have heart disease or cancer or diabetes or arthritis or fibromyalgia or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or macular degeneration and cataracts, ileitis, colitis, spastic, all of those are associated with inflammation, which is why I continue to remind everyone, anti-inflammatory is the key. Interesting, last evening, even though I'm out on the road, as one of those coincidental things happen, I was doing work, and this person who was a carpenter where I was doing some filming was listening in on a conversation and said, you know, I've got a daughter and I've got a son, both who are autistic, and it's rough. And so I asked him to come back later in the day when I'd finished my work, and I talk with him and his wife, and virtually every single morsel of food they put in their mouth, every single beverage is highly inflammatory. So I gave them an anti-inflammation diet, and when I was finished, even though it was loaded with beans and grains and fruits and vegetables and starchy vegetables, and the woman says, I'm not used to eating or preparing any of this stuff. We live on pizzas and hot dogs and hamburgers and french fries and all other kinds of things, but candies. And they were all overweight. The kids were bouncing all over the place. And I said, well, try this for a month and see what happens. You turn off the inflammation in a child's gut, and you turn off inflammation in a child's brain, and you turn off inflammation in a child's circulatory system, you can calm a child down. child with ADD or Asperger's or autism. I've done it too many times not to know that it doesn't work. Now then, how much you do beyond that depends upon the repair of the damage in the brain, almost always due to vaccines. And then you can start to see with chelation therapy and with brain and neurological rebuilding, which is entirely doable, how all this comes together. It's positive. So they, meaning the Harvard and University of California researchers, found the mechanisms specifically of how the biosynthetic pathway for myosin biosynthesis, and found that human macrophages are responsible for converting DHA to the novel epioxide intermediate 13S and 14S epoxymyosin. Then they learned how to synthesize the molecule and found that the myosins caused macrophages to change their type so they no longer caused inflammation. Now, that's a lot of science, but it's just to let you know, I'm happy with the fact that they actually now have a mechanism. Now, why is that important? Because I will never forget my first radio debate on WMCA radio. And Barry Farber was moderating the debate. And it was with the Arthritis Foundation and myself. We would later try to debate Frederick Stare of Harvard, the cornflakes professor who supported the sugar industry. But on the day of the debate, which had been promoted for several weeks, Barry was there in the studio. I was there, and Dr. Stare couldn't be bothered. He was playing tennis, he said. Sure, he couldn't be bothered because I had a lot of information on where the money from Harvard came from his department. In any case, the person from the Arthritis Foundation, a board-certified rheumatologist with an outstanding reputation, said there is no connection between anything you're going to drink or eat and arthritis, either causing it or helping it. So any claims to that are simply quackery. I presented evidence that in cultures around the world that do not have a refined diet, high in saturated fats and trans fats, as we do in the United States, and sugars, that you do not have the same incidence of arthritis. And in fact, in some beekeepers, you have the beekeeper having no arthritis and people actually coming to get stung by the bee in a controlled environment where the beekeeper just holds the bee and puts it on the person's skin that gets stung, which is relieving it. Then I had interviewed some scientists, European doctors, medical doctors, who said it's very common, and yes, it works. So I then had taken a trip to Europe to find out all these natural treatments from in Italy, the water treatments, and the magnetic treatments in Germany that we weren't using in the United States, were clueless about. Now, today, we not only have dozens of major studies showing that you can turn on inflammation, including arthritis, or turn it off, from peer-reviewed mainstream journals, but now we know how it's done. We have the actual scientific evidence, and it was done at Harvard and University of California, which means that it won't be challenged now. So that's all crucial. Now, here's a takeaway moment. What do you think would have happened had the media done their homework instead of simply accepting the official source and looked into it? They would have found the same information I had. That meant that long ago, tens of millions of people would not have had to suffer from the debilitation of chronic disease. Millions, tens of millions of lives could have been improved and many saved. But you can always count upon the media never to be ahead of any curve. Ever. And if you doubt me, ask them when was the last time they blew the whistle. Oh, I forgot. No, it has to be someone outside, a Bradley Manning or a Snowden, that tells us the truth. Our American media chooses not to find it. And the last couple of things I want to share with you today, one is about black beans. Most Americans don't eat much beans because they fear that, well, they don't like the taste of them, or unless it's baked beans, and or they're going to be gaseous. And you can make beans very exciting aesthetically, but also there are ways of cooking them and soaking them with some vinegar in them that can neutralize the gas. But more importantly, what does the bean do for us? Well, first of all, for those of us who are vegan, it's an outstanding source of easily absorbed amino acids. Now, amino acids are the building blocks of protein. So if I'm getting some organic soybeans or pinto beans, let's say I'm getting 20 grams of protein in a serving, which is a cup. Well, that's as much as someone's going to get in a hamburger. The difference is they're getting dead meat with no life force and energy. They're getting growth-stimulating antibiotics and hormones, and they're getting toxins and bacteria and viruses. I'm getting high-quality fiber, phytonutrients, antioxidants, all and complete amino acids, quality equal to that of meat. And a lot less expensive. Beans are a very inexpensive way of feeding people. And one of the things I do when people are suffering from economic privations is I shift them over to a vegan diet where lentils and pulses and legumes, what historically around the world are considered the poor people's protein. Yeah, and it's the best protein, but it is inexpensive, so you can save a lot of money. Here's the latest on black beans. There's new research that shows that they can fight cancer cell lines of various types of cancers. Some researchers at the Monterey Institute of Technology, which is a very prestigious research institute, found that black bean sprouts are substantially strong in anti-carcinogenic issues against breast cancer, liver cancer, and colorectal cancer. And the researchers found that after 3 days and 5 days of germination, the phytonutrient extracted isolated from the sprouts were also able to inhibit the growth of all cancer cells. And they also tested the same sprout isolates against non-cancerous or healthy cells as controls and found no negative impact at all. The sprouts only inhibited the cancer cells. The researchers then isolated some of the constituents of the sprouted beans and found that the saponins, SAP, S-A-P, onins, O-N-I-N-S, and flavonoids had the greatest inhibition against liver and colon cancer cells. Meanwhile, the genistein content of the sprouts was found to inhibit the breast cancer. The researchers also found that black bean sprouts to be particularly high in antioxidants. So the takeaway message here is, by including black beans, including black bean sprouts, you're able to have strong nutrition, but also anti-cancer properties. And I also want to mention that new research shows that the emotions, quote, are closely linked to perception, and very often our emotional response really helps us to deal with reality. That's of sound. This is new research, according to Christina Sarich. Those who have been through combat know that post-traumatic stress disorder can be triggered by sounds as benign as thunder. That immediately takes someone back to the experiences on the battlefield that they want to forget. The same is true of others who've been in trauma or deep emotions that are set off by sounds that are non-traumatic in their essence, but result in feelings of great fear and anxiety. Until now, scientists didn't know what caused this in the brain. But now, according to research from the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature Neuroscience, they have found that link. Now, that link, of course, we all know because you feel it when you hear beautiful sounds. It relaxes you. Meditative sounds, just like chimes playing. Let the wind blow through chimes, and it's just so relaxing. A flute, it creates almost a sense of melancholy. But when you're in a movie and they want to build suspense, they do it through music. In a horror film, it's through music, and that's triggering a part of our brain that they now have been able to locate that then sets off fear based upon what was a conditional response to earlier in life. And finally, for those of you who know anyone who have mycoplasma, which are not good microorganisms. They can be very bad. Mycoplasma is the smallest free-living disease agent found in humans and is unclassified as either a virus or bacteria, but possesses characteristics of both. Now, the microbes have no cell walls and were originally thought to be related only to several strains of pneumonia. However, researchers have now identified at least 7 mycoplasma species, and due to their size and lack of cell walls, mycoplasma are capable of doing great damage to the body, and quite frankly, treatment with antibiotics is generally ineffective. So, what do we find out that actually kills them and disables the opportunistic infections? How about natural substances? Now, what are some of the natural substances? Mullein, M-U-L-L-E-I-N. Mycoplasma pneumonia is especially common in children and those under 40, being highly contagious and usually transmitted through coughing and sneezing. And that herb, mullein, cures or brings relief from many symptoms. It's an astringent, meaning it acts as an expectorant to break up congestion in the lungs and airways. And this was according to Healthcare Clinic. It's a potent germicide and reduces inflammation. And so that is important. Then you have Seneca snake root. Seneca, S-E-N-E-C-A, snake root. It's another herb found to be efficacious in the treatment of mycoplasma-related pneumonia. And it's similar to mullein in action. It relieves congestion in the airways, acting as an expectorant to help the patient cough up tough mucus and phlegm. And it's also good for concomitant symptoms like asthma and bronchitis. Then green tea. Certain mycoplasma strains cause other diseases besides pneumonia, and an inflammation of the inner lining of the urethra is one. And there, green tea works best, generally at 200 to 500 milligrams. And that was according to study in the University of Maryland Medical Center. And so those are the ones that can make a difference. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
That's where I want to be. Flow, river, flow. Let your waters wash down. Take me from this road to some other town. All he wanted was to be free, and that's the way turned out to be. Flow, river, flow. Let your waters wash down. Keep me from this road to
some. Nice having with us, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. We're heard everywhere. We're the number one listened to internet radio station anywhere that I'm aware of, and we want to thank all the people for also making us number one listening over the telephone. And I'll give you that telephone number in a minute, because this way, anywhere in North America, including Canada, that you'd like to listen in, you can, and that's important. I want to make sure that you don't miss anything. And a lot of people historically, they couldn't be tied to the computer. You know, they say, well, Gary, I can't be at a computer that hour. I couldn't be at a land-based radio at that hour. So you don't have to be. Today you can dial in a number, and I'll give you that number in a moment. A short commentary from Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report. The Obamas do Africa. The president and his family are spending a week in sub-Saharan Africa with Senegal, Tanzania, and South Africa on the itinerary. The focus of the trip, if you believe the White House, is trade, an arena in which the United States has been eclipsed by China since 2009. China, by some measurement, now does nearly twice as much business with Africa as the United States, and the gap is growing. It is now commonly accepted that the Chinese offer far better terms of trade and investment than the Americans, that they create more jobs for Africans, and their investments leave behind infrastructure that can enrich their African trading partners in the long haul. No one expects Obama to offer anything on this trip that will reverse America's declining share of the African market. That's because the United States is not in the business of fair and mutually beneficial trade. It's about the business of imperialism, which is another matter entirely. The Americans ensure their access to African natural resources through the barrel of a gun. So while the Chinese and the Indians and the Brazilians and other economic powerhouses play by the rules of give and take, the U.S. tightens its military grip on the continent through its ever-expanding military command, AFRICOM. To justify its rapid militarization of Africa, Washington plunges whole regions of the continent into chaos. U.S. policies under Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama have utterly destroyed Somalia, made the Horn of Africa a theater of war, drawn the northern tier of the continent into America's cauldron of terror, and killed 6 million people in the eastern Congo. Let me repeat that, killed 6 million people in the eastern Congo. The face of American Africa is war, not trade, extraction of minerals by military intimidation, not conventional commerce. Washington's priority is to embed AFRICOM even deeper into the militaries of African states, rather than configuring more favorable trade relationships on the continent. But you won't learn that from the U.S. corporate media, which chooses to focus on, the $100 million cost of Obama's African trip, or to look for human interest angles on Obama's decision not to touch down in his father's homeland, Kenya. However, even that angle is too sinister for deeper exploration by corporate press, because Kenya's absence from the itinerary is meant as a threat. The United States is angry because Washington wanted the Kenyan people to elect a different president, one more acceptable to the U.S. policymakers. The Americans expected the whole of Kenya civil society to bend to Washington's will and reject the candidacy of a Kenyatta, simply to please the superpower. When that didn't happen, it was decided that Kenya must be shunned, despite its past services to U.S. imperialism. Skipping Kenya was a warning that more serious repercussions may lurk in the future, which is a potent threat because the United States controls most of the guns of Africa. As U.S.-backed warlord in Somalia said to Jeremy Scahill in his excellent film, The Dirty Wars, quote, "The Americans are masters of war. War and the threat of war is the reality behind every U.S. president visit to Africa and everywhere else. Whether the terms are trade or good or bad, the declining U.S. empire will get access to the resources it needs, or thousands, maybe millions, will die." End quote, Glenn Ford. I wanted to share that with you because Glenn is one of the most courageous, honest people as a journalist out there. We hear a lot about Jeremy Scahill, and Jeremy does good work, and I respect that. We should hear equally what Glenn Ford does, because he does equally good work. But he is not given the same attention that others are, because he's just he is not a corporate liberal. For those of you who would like to listen to this program, millions upon millions upon millions of minutes have been listened. Call 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869. And finally, before we go to our guest, who I was just told are standing by, I'm interested always in if a person says something, do they back it up? Well, how many times have we heard in recent years that you shouldn't be concerned if the government's watching you? If it has embedded in your television a camera system, in your smart meter, a way of knowing where you're at in your house, what conversations you have, surveillance at every level, what you've heard about, we've been talking about for years, and I've written about in many articles. For example, I wrote the first article anywhere on secret experiments in massive amounts in October of 1989, a feature cover story for a major magazine. Nothing happened because of it. And then again, nothing ever happens because of anything, because at that time we really weren't using the internet in a way that helped enlighten people. Today, one article that Richard Gale and I wrote, one article we believe was read by over 50 million people worldwide. It was posted on 228,000 different sites, including the Times of India and a lot of major sites. So today, magazines are just passé. It's irrelevant. That's why I don't write for them anymore. I wrote over 600 articles. Today, it's the internet. So we can verify facts very quickly today. So if the government says, you must give us the right to spy because we can't capture the people likely to commit a crime. All right, let's take a look. The latest murder statistics for the world, murders per 100,000 of citizens. I'll give you some. Here are the people whose murder rate is Honduras. That's the one place in the world, if you don't want to get a shot, you shouldn't live. 90, almost 92. El Salvador, 69. Jamaica, 52. Venezuela, 45. Belize, 41. Now, here's all who's ahead of us. U.S. Virgin Islands, Guatemala, St. Kitts, Nevis, Zambia, Uganda, Malawi, Lesotho, Trinidad, Tobago, Colombia, South Africa, Congo, Central African Republic, Bahamas, Puerto Rico, St. Lucia, Dominican Republic, Tanzania, Sudan, St. Vincent, Ethiopia, Dominican Republic, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Panama, Brazil, and then almost every place in Africa, then Greenland. And let me go to some of the north, Rwanda, Mexico, Chad, Sierra Leone, Zimbabwe, and Russia is ahead of us, Peru, Liberia, Costa Rica, and most of the Middle East is ahead of us. Ukraine is ahead of us. Cuba is ahead of us. Yeah, you heard me right, Cuba. And we're way down there. We're at 4.2 per 100,000. We're 109th in the world, 109th in countries where people are more likely to get murdered than the United States. If we were up in the top 10, that's one thing. We're in the bottom part, and yet we make this issue. So think about that the next time they demand rights over you. Let's go to my guest standing by. I'd like to welcome all of you. This is a part of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. My guest is Dr. Bruce Lipton. He was a researcher at the Stanford University School of Medicine from 1987 to 92. And among his discoveries was identifying a mechanism in cells that function like a brain in the founding of a field of cellular biology known as epigenetics. He's now recognized as one of the leading voices in the new biology of mind-body medicine. His book, The Biology of Belief, is now a landmark in the field. He also has a recent book, The Honeymoon Effect, The Science of Creating Heaven on Earth, which applies to the principles of most recent realizations from epigenetics and molecular biology and quantum physics. Nice to have you with us today.
Gary, thank you so very much for this opportunity. I so appreciate it, and I just want to acknowledge how much I appreciate what you're doing to help us go through the evolution that we're undergoing right now.
Thank you. Since epigenetics remains a new theory and we're still learning so much more about epigenetic phenomena as further research is conducted, very few, aside from yourself, have started to look at what epigenetic theory can tell us about other disciplines and life sciences such as psychology, sexuality, and spirituality. We might remember that the University of California, Berkeley physicist Fritjof Capra accomplished this with quantum physics. In his seminal Tao of Physics, Capra basically removed quantum theory from the laboratory and to investigate what it can tell us about consciousness and mystical experiences. So I'd like you to take your time and share with us what you feel epigenetics can teach us to better understand psychology and in particular the nature of relationships, both romantic and platonic.
Well, basically, there's a revolution in understanding in the science that almost all of us have been programmed with, almost everybody out there, and this also includes information in today's current textbooks. reveal that genes apparently control our traits, our characteristics, behaviors, emotions, etc., a concept called genetic determinism. And why that teaching is so detrimental is that you ask somebody, you say, well, did you pick the genes you came with? And they'll say, well, not as far as I know. I say, if you don't like the traits you have, can you just go and change the genes to get different traits? And the answer is no. And then you realize, well, if genes control you and you have no influence over your genes, by definition, that makes you a victim and a victim of your heredity. Oh, my God, there's cancer, my family, diabetes, Alzheimer's, and I, a recipient of these genes, and I'm looking, you know, like this is going to happen to me. Well, the problem with that is the moment you tell somebody they're a victim, you've taken away their power, number one. And number two, you also sell them the need for a rescuer. And a rescuer comes in and says, look, you're a victim, and I'm going to compensate for your inability, and that's called the pharmaceutical industry. And the pharmaceutical people come in and say, yeah, your life is not in your control, and we're here to help you. Well, epigenetics is a complete reversal of that, because epigenetics reveals a very simple fact, and that is genes are not self-actualizing. That means genes do not make decisions. Genes are blueprints. They're exactly, you know, functionally identical to a blueprint that an architect is working on. And I say, well, why is that important? Because I say, well, talk to an architect, and they're working on a blueprint, and say, is your blueprint on or off? And they'll look at you like, what, are you crazy? It's a blueprint. There's no on and off. And I go, you know, the whole world's been programmed that genes turn on and off. And the fact is, no, they're blueprints. And then why that becomes important is if you understand them as blueprints, then you realize it's not the blueprint that is running the show. It's the contractor who reads the blueprints. And that turns out to be our perception of the world, our mind, our beliefs and emotions. And why that becomes important, it's a revolution. If the genes are controlled by the environment and your response to the environment, then you're not a victim in this sense, because you're the one that can change the environment, change your perception, and when you do that, you change your genetics. So rather than perceiving ourselves as victims, the new science says we are masters, except if it's really based on our perceptions and belief, and if I program you to be a victim and that becomes your belief, then by definition that belief disempowers you, and then you manifest the victim program. And this is why it's so important. This is so important for us to get back how powerful we really are, except for the belief that says we're not.
All right, I appreciate that. Since we live our lives being only fully conscious and aware of the present moment for about, as you and others have suggested, 5% of the time, and the remaining 95% of the time, we're operating from our subconscious mind that is based upon beliefs and assumptions conditioned from our past, we need to conclude that we're failing dismally to deal with each moment of choice and decision and interaction from a realized perspective. However, you claim that when we are deeply in love with a partner, we find ourselves much more conscious for the majority of the time we are with that person. So I would like you to speak about the importance of that in our relationships, and then speak about our subconscious conditioning affecting our sexual lives negatively and how this ends up manifesting.
It's very important if we start with the basic premise of epigenetics that our perception, which includes our mind's activities, control our genes. We start with that as a given. And then we say, well, where do you get your perceptions from? And then I say, well, there's the mind, but then we talk about two parts to the mind, the conscious mind, which is connected to your personal identity, your uniqueness, your spirit. That's the conscious mind. And the subconscious mind is actually just like a database of stored programs. That's all it is behavioral programs stored where you push the button and you make a response, stimulus response. And so basically when you're operating from the subconscious, there's no thinking involved at all, no consciousness in the sense of creativity. It's just pre-programmed behaviors. And when you're in the conscious mind, that's where you express your wishes, desires, aspirations for life. So when you're being conscious and controlling your behavior and your cognitive activity with conscious mind, that means that every decision you make is based on your wishes and your desires. When you switch into the subconscious program, then you're just going to play off a database of whatever the stored programs are. And then fundamentally, the big issue about this is there's two big issues. Number one is when you switch to the subconscious, the reason why you do that is because when the conscious mind is thinking, when it's thinking into the future, reviewing the past, or just contemplating ideas, by definition, then the conscious mind's not paying attention at the current moment. And when the conscious mind's not paying attention, the default switches automatically all behavior over to the subconscious programming. Well, there's a problem with that, and the problem with that is twofold. Number one is that when you're switching into the subconscious behavior, you yourself are not seeing it for a simple reason, because your conscious mind is not paying attention. That's why you're playing the subconscious program. So that means when you're switching to the subconscious mode, whatever behavior you're expressing, you yourself are not personally aware of it. You don't see it. This is like, for example, you may have had a friend in the past. You know your friend's behavior very, very well. You happen to know your friend's parent. And at some point, you may, you know, volunteer to your friend something like, hey, you know, Bill, you're just like your dad. And the reason why Bill is like that is because the subconscious programming, the fundamental programming, is actually downloaded by observing other people. So as you grow up in your family, you observe your family's behavior, your parents' behavior, your culture's behavior, and that becomes your fundamental programs in your subconscious. But when you play it, you don't see it. So you tell Bill, hey, Bill, you're just like your dad, and then he gets ballistic and says, how can you compare me to my dad? And most people laugh because they're so familiar with it. And I say, but this is profoundly important for a very simple reason, and that is this. Everybody else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. It's only Bill who doesn't see it. And I say, why is this important? Because we're all Bill. Every one of us, 95% of the day, are playing subconscious programs. And the reason is simple. Is because 95% of the day our mind is in thought. And when it's in thought, then we play the default, but then we don't see it. And here's the big problem. If the default programs are limiting, disempowering, self-sabotaging, and you don't see it, that means as you're going through your life, you're sabotaging yourself with no vision that you're even doing it. And as a result, when things don't work out the way you want them to work out, then we look at the world and go, oh, well, it wasn't me. I had the intention to be successful, and it didn't work. So the world's against me. The universe is against me. It's not in my fate to have this. And it's like, oh, my God, it's completely misunderstood. It's because it's our own invisible behavior that sabotages us because we don't see it. And the reason why the behavior sabotages us, it's not our behavior that we're playing fundamentally. It's behavior that we download in the first 7 years of our lives, because our brain in the first 7 years of our lives is predominantly operating at an EEG frequency called theta, which is imagination, and that's why children are so involved in mixing the real and the imaginary world together before age seven. And why this also is becoming so important is that these programs are really from observing these other people, and they don't have your wishes and desires and your interests. And, you know, and why this is so important is that means 95% of the time, the behavior you're living in is not your wishes and desires, and you don't see that you're doing it, which means I feel like a victim. It's like my life didn't work. I'm like a victim because I really intended to be healthy, successful, whatever, and it didn't. It just didn't happen. And it's very interesting because the concept of programming somebody and controlling their lives is not just a new scientific insight into the nature of consciousness. Because think about this. The Jesuits have boasted for 500 years. They said, give me a child and I will show you the man, or more vernacular, they would say, give me a child until it's six or seven and it will belong to the church for the rest of its life. What did they know? And they knew this. If I can program your
Go ahead.
No, if I can program your Yes, Gary.
I'm just thinking, how many people, their sexual life belongs to the church?
Oh, my God.
Not to them.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you went into most churches, you could open up a vault and there's Mary and Jane and Tom and Bob's vagina and their sexual organs because they don't belong to them. The control over people's sexuality is palpable.
And here's what they did. It's a violation of nature. Think about this. Organisms that are not conscious like we are, they survive. And how do they survive in a world without, like, a school to say, you should do this and you should do that? If you don't teach, like, even an amoeba, how does an amoeba know whether to go the right way or the wrong way? And the answer is, nature provided an understanding and behavior that is related on harmony, related to harmony and disharmony. And basically it says this, when an organism is moving in a direction that threatens its existence, the system becomes more disharmonious and loses energy, and energy is life. You have energy, you got life. You have no energy, you have no life. So a system reads the energy, and it reads when it's in harmony and disharmony. And so you don't need a school teacher for a cell. A cell will move in the right direction because if it's going in the right direction, it's gaining energy. And if it's going in the wrong direction, it's losing energy. And I said, well, that's for a cell level. I said, well, what about to a human level? I said, same thing, except the gaining of energy is called pleasure, and losing of energy is called pain. That's nature's way of saying, hey, if you're going in the wrong direction, it's going to hurt, and that's going to tell you to turn around and go the other way. And then I say, isn't it amazing that the church has switched that around, that if it's pleasurable, then it's sinful and not right, and if it hurts, then that's good. You know, so the Opus Dei people, they beat themselves with brambles until they bleed. Why? Because there's no pleasure in that, and that pain really says, it allows you to focus on the afterlife, not on the present life. So if your life is painful here, then you really look forward to where it's not going to be painful. And according to the church, oh yeah, not on this planet. This is a struggle here, so if you're feeling pleasure on this planet, then you're being distracted from the end goal. And so they took nature and swiveled it 180 degrees out of range so that acknowledging that pain is good for you and that pleasure is all sin is like, oh my God, that's completely antagonistic to what nature was all about. And knowing that if I can program your first 7 years, it doesn't make a difference what your wishes and desires are, conscious mind. Because they knew that the subconscious was going to direct them. So that's what they said. Give me the child. I'll program it. And I don't care what that child's wishes and desires are. They will always belong to the church because I put the program in there. And then I say, wow, this is fundamentally so important that you think that the leadership of this world ignored this fact over the last 500 years, even though the Jesuits have boasted about it? And the answer is, of course not. They know exactly the whole story. If I can program your first 7 years, I own your life. And it's interesting because the movie, The Matrix, which I joke about in my lectures, I say, you know, The Matrix, you say, you find that in the video store? You say, it's under science fiction. I go, oh, no, this shouldn't be there. The Matrix is a documentary. It's a documentary. We have been programmed. And to get your life back, you have to take that red pill and get out of the program. And then so just to let people understand this, well, what would be the consequence of getting out of the program? And then this is the emphasis of the new book, The Honeymoon Effect, is this is exactly what happens when you fall in love. When you fall in love and you get so involved with this other person, you don't let your mind wander because everything you wanted is in front of your face. So rather than letting your mind wander, stays in control, not 5% of the time, but 90% or more. And I say, why is that relevant? Well, conscious mind is wishes and desires. If you don't play the programs that have been limiting you and you operate from wishes and desires, what did you do in your life? And the answer is, you manifested the honeymoon. And all of a sudden it says, oh my God, without the programming, we all go toward the honeymoon. We go to heaven on earth. And then you realize, then the function of the programming was to disempower you and take that away from you. And it's like, exactly what it is.
Okay, great insight. I have one final question for you.
Yes.
But I'm going to interrelate, I'm going to bring together several different principles here. Several years ago, there was a large study published by the Journal of the American Medical Association that found 43% of American women were sexually dysfunctional, which is being defined that they don't have a strong desire for sex or enjoy it, and if we or can't reach orgasm. And if we apply the principles of epigenetic to these findings, we might say that there has been a cultural environment of sexual dysfunction that contributes to the negative feelings women have about sex. And I would imagine that if the journal had done the men's survey, they would have probably found it even more dysfunctional as a nightmare. So I'd like to hear your comments about this statistic and that what it really says about us as a society. But I want to add one issue on here, and I've seen this so many times, where, let's just use one example. It could be a male or female, where a person talks about love, but everything they actually share is not real love. It's highly conditional, because the backhand is always prepared if the person doesn't get what they want. If they don't hear the right words, if they don't get the right input, then suddenly it's almost demonic, the kind of effort that people go to try to demonize you or disempower you. And then a lot of it is sexualized. And then in one particular case that was in one of the workshops I did, where someone got up and gave their whole story, and it was on a sexual healing workshop, this person had a very dysfunctional father who was well known in academia, but tyrannical, verbally abusive, and this is what the woman grew up with. And hence she said that every relationship she's tried to have, she ended up sabotaging, because she acts out. She becomes extremely emotionally volatile and violent. And at the same time, she is smart enough to understand that her father's upbringing of her had to have something to do with this. She just can't get beyond it. I'm sure that that is common in both men and women all over the United States, where they don't look back at what they became as an extension of their own upbringing from their mother or father or the environment they grew up in. That ties in with what you were saying, the Jesuits. Well, the average person doesn't have a Jesuit living with them for the first 6 years to condition them. They have a mother and father. But that mother and father and the epigenetics of that mother and father, the even unaware mindset of the mother and father, can definitely play a role in what later happens to a person who evolves and then finds out they're running into brick walls, self-sabotaging, hurting other people, and are not able to change it. Could you address this, please?
Absolutely, Gary. And the whole idea is this. Number one about epigenetics is it's not just passing genetic information from parent to child. It's actually passing genetic information from grandparents to parents, to child, and even earlier. So a lineage of behavior in a family is unconsciously passed down for generations. So you don't have to, you know, program the parents to affect the children. The great-grandparents, the great-great-parents, these were the ones that were affected by it. So basically, epigenetics reveals that you can propagate behavior in a family unconsciously through an entire lineage. In fact, here's an interesting understanding about cancer, because what the people have recognized is that a child who is adopted into a family that has a lineage of cancer in it, the adopted child will get the cancer with the same propensity as any natural sibling. What that really means is this. We've always attributed cancer to heredity, and now it turns out less than 10% of cancer is heredity. It's behavioral programming that is passed through a family, and it can go for generations. So you don't have to program them just in the previous generation. You can go back way earlier. And then you say, well, why is this dysfunctional programming here? And again, we go back to the church, and it's the extension today to the government. They knew something then that is so profoundly important to this, and it really has gotten lost because a dear friend of mine, James Prescott, he was head of the branch of Child Health and Human Development from the National Institute of Health, came up with an understanding about the consequence of violence. And the significance was when he reported on it, and he said that the church and government are knowingly making violent people. The paper was a legitimate, totally wonderful scientific understanding. They fired him in a minute. They got rid of him right away because he exposed a deep understanding. And here's what the church knew, and then the government has taken over, and that is this. Pleasure, and especially if a child is raised in pleasure, it changes their response to stress. There's like a thermostat in the brain that regulates the stress response, just like a thermostat in the house. When you reach a certain temperature, it turns it on or off. Well, the stress, there's like a thermostat for stress. And that what they found out is when a child is given pleasure and giving loving and touching, and it's like somatosensory, that means body sensory touching, when you hold a child lovingly, the thermostat changes in the brain for stress. It lowers it so that when the stress response starts, it almost shuts right back off again. Children that are loved and given pleasure have hardly any response to stress because as their stress levels rise up, the brain, there's a thermostat in the brain that shuts off the response. It shuts it off early. If you deny pleasure, you change the thermostat setting, and you push it up higher and higher so that much more stress hormones come into the system before the system feedback shuts it off. You say, well, why is that relevant? I say, visualize a picture of a thermometer being heated up and the mercury going up and then blowing out the top. Well, blowing out the top is violence. And if you put the thermostat setting up near the top so that lots of stress hormones come in before you can shut it off, it gets to the point where it becomes violent. Well, why is this relevant? Because you can regulate violence in people and work them up so that you can push them to the point of fighting if the thermostat is real high. If the thermostat is set real low, people are in pleasure and people are having a good life, and you come to them and you try to work them up and say, look, we're going to go fight and we're going to go kill these people. And the people that are in pleasure go, yeah, all right, you guys go do that. I'm not involved because you can't elevate my stress level to engage me. But if I put the thermostat real high, I can work you up to the point where that thermometer is ready to blow at the moment I want it to. That's what they knew for hundreds of years, and this is how they control people, because if I can get you to respond to violence and I can work you up, you will fight for me. But if you don't respond to violence, then it's, you know, it's a very difficult thing to muster people up to get them to fight. They won't do it. And so guess what? This is what Prescott, you know, with research on the cultures that have existed, research in the scientific labs, all have come to the same point. We can create a violent population by denying pleasure. And then when you think about it, you say, yeah, look at the church. What did they do? They put all the pressure against women, and they made them sinful. You know, it was Eve who ate the apple, and it was women who caused the downfall of all this stuff. So we blame all the women. Why? A source of pleasure, which would keep the men from fighting. and so we deny women and blame them, and we put taboos on all sorts of pleasure because we say that's negative. And then I say, what's the net consequence? The answer is those people that have experienced that, their thermostat setting for violence is so close to the violent point that it doesn't take very much to work them up, to push them over the level. Yeah, but now what did you do? You biologically created total dysfunction in the system because, remember, nature said, if I give you pleasure, then you're going in the right direction. If I deny pleasure, I'm preventing you from living out a full, healthy life on this planet. And it's interesting because the programming that does that, remember, is subconscious. And I say, well, why is that relevant? Because when we understand that we create a honeymoon response by not going into the subconscious program, by keeping the conscious mind present, then people operate from their wishes and desires. And, of course, personally, their wishes and desires are to have a healthy, happy, harmonious, heaven-on-earth experience. Every average person wants that. But every average person is only operating 5% of the time from that mind.
Bruce, we're out of time. You've given us an enormous amount of insight. I appreciate it. Just consider this in our closing thought. Think of how many people today are allowing their rights and freedoms to a happy and healthy life, to a peaceful life, be taken over by the conditioning of the masses to surrender their freedoms because of artificial fears. The church has done it historically. Most religions have done it. They've subordinated women's rights. And even in our school systems, we are doing this. I appreciate the important work you've done. The book is The Honeymoon Effect. It's brucelipton.com. Bruce, thank you for being with us.
I so appreciate it. Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. This has been a continuation of our Conversations with Remarkable Mind series. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. And now we go to Utrecht Lead. Hi, Utrecht.
Hello, Gary. Today it is open forum where people decide where we ought to go.
Excellent. We look forward to it. Right.
Thanks.
Now, Utrecht Lead.